Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out why the California Condor's comeback has hit a new milestone, and why Valley farmers might soon be using virtual reality to tour their orchards and vineyards. We begin, though, with the issue of human trafficking. A few weeks ago, the Fresno Police Department busted a sex trafficking ring among the Bulldog Gang. Unfortunately, only the latest of many sex trafficking cases uncovered in the Valley. This kind of crime is likely what comes to mind when you think of human trafficking, but another kind of trafficking also occurs in the Valley, sometimes in plain sight. And law enforcement officials worry it's far more common than most people might think. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports.
A few years ago, a woman we'll call Francisca found herself in a bad situation getting worse. She and her young daughter had just crossed the desert into the U.S. in the dead of night. They had been struggling to make ends meet in Mexico City and had been promised a better life up north. Francisca says her extended family had agreed to help pay their way. But shortly after making the illicit crossing, she says the woman who had smuggled them had some bad news.
The lady contacted me and said that my family was no longer responding. And there was no way that I could communicate with my family because our cell phones had already been taken away.
We're protecting Francisca's identity and whereabouts because of what happened next. Francisca and her daughter spoke no English. They knew no one else. So they went to live with this woman in the San Joaquin Valley, then found themselves forced into working for her. For months, Francisca says she spent her days in the fields, her evenings doing housework.
They also used the excuse that I owed them a little over $10,000, and I had to work to pay that debt off.
But a few neighbors took notice. Francisca says one night, they drove up to the house and tried to rescue her and her daughter. Their captors caught them and blocked the car from leaving.
At that moment, they opened the car door and they pulled my hair out and they dragged me out of the car. And I had no choice but to go with them. They threatened all of us not to call the police or they would call ICE.
The neighbors did call the police. Sheriff's deputies arrived at the house, brought Francisca and her daughter to a shelter, and arrested three of their captors. Law enforcement has investigated the case, and the local district attorney is currently reviewing it for criminal charges. What Francisca experienced was human labor trafficking through fraud, force, and coercion. Though labor trafficking cases appear to be much less common than sex trafficking cases, they're also harder to recognize and even harder to prosecute. But local law enforcement agencies are devoting more resources to trafficking cases. They worry they're only scratching the surface, partly because the geography of the valley itself may be attractive to traffickers.
If you think again about the concept of isolation used by many traffickers to keep someone under their control, rural communities are perfect examples of where individuals may be isolated.
Melissa Gomez is program manager of Central Valley Against Human Trafficking, an arm of the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission that helps survivors access therapy and services. More human trafficking cases are reported in California than in any other state. Roughly a sixth involve labor trafficking, mostly in industries like domestic work, agriculture, and traveling sales crews. Gomez's organization alone serves almost 500 trafficking survivors from Merced to Kern counties, though not all of them were trafficked here. Fresno County Deputy District Attorney Lynette Gonzalez suspects the scale of labor trafficking is actually much larger. Unlike with sex trafficking, labor trafficking survivors are overwhelmingly foreign nationals, many undocumented. Gonzalez suspects many victims never report what happened.
It could be language barriers. It could be that their immigration status might not, they might be in fear that that would be exposed or that they might be subjected to removal. fear of the police is a general thing, and that's very common for both labor and sex trafficking.
Gonzalez is the prosecutor in what she believes is one of the first labor trafficking cases to make it to trial in California. A Fresno resident has been charged with 6 felony counts of trafficking and extortion for forcing Mexican immigrants into agricultural work.
These are migrant workers, and there was no actual physical violence or sexual assault or exploitation that was going on, but the level of psychological control was pretty immense.
That case will go to trial in Fresno Superior Court in November. The Fresno County DA's office recently upped its involvement in human trafficking cases, devoting more staff to the issue and working in tandem with local police departments and support groups, a collaboration Senator Dianne Feinstein lauded when she visited Fresno earlier this year. But these officials rely on the public's help, too. Many of these cases began with calls to 911 or the National Human Trafficking Hotline. It was vigilant neighbors and police that eventually rescued Francisca. And that better future, she's beginning to glimpse it once again. She works as a cook and recently enrolled at a local community college.
I want to further my education. I want to be a teacher. I want to be an example for my daughter. I want my daughter to know that she can be strong and that no matter what happens to her, nobody has the right to take those dreams away from her.
Meanwhile, she now has a work permit and is applying for permanent residency. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. Farmers across California are relying more and more on technology to help them manage their crops. And often that means working with unmanned aerial systems. Using drones to make two-dimensional maps of orchards isn't anything new. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, one ag researcher here in the Valley is taking existing drone technology to the next level.
Take over. Your point has been updated. Please check it on the map.
Ali Poreza is flying a little white drone over a field of nectarines near Parlier, south of Fresno. The camera on the drone is collecting images as it flies back and forth over the field. Poreza is an engineer at the Kearney Agricultural Research and Extension Center. In Perez's hand is a remote control hooked up to his iPhone.
So in real time, you can see what's going on. So it goes all to 200 feet. That's the target altitude. And then it goes to the starting point.
The images and data he's collecting will later be run through a computer system that creates a 3D map of the field. It takes those 2D images and puts them into 3D.
It's a virtual reality, actually. So basically, you can put on one of those goggles and walk through a virtual orchard. So this is something interesting, even for people who are not in agriculture.
He says he got the idea earlier this year when he realized no one else was utilizing drones in this way on farms.
I saw that they use this technology to reconstruct an accident. And I was impressed that no one has used this technology for agriculture. And I thought that it's very potential, but I didn't know until I create my first 3D map.
The 3D maps Poreza is creating are almost like a video game. With this technology, a farmer can sit at his kitchen table, but also be virtually walking through a field and zooming into parts of the orchard that look stressed. A farmer can even look at a time lapse of the exact spot and then make a decision on things like irrigation and pesticide use. Poreza says these virtual vineyards hold a lot of promise because they cut down the time a farmer or crews need to spend in the field.
I think virtual orchard opens a lot of door to collect more precise information and convert them to valuable knowledge that will result in good decisions for growers.
But there is an issue. It costs around $100,000 to use existing remote sensing technology to do this. Poreza says he's developing a low-cost alternative with a drone equipped with a camera, a computer program to process the data, and a smartphone. Hanford pistachio farmer James Nichols is testing out the virtual orchard technology.
There's always going to be a need to go out into the field, but I think this is going to be able to quantify things that we have never been able to do in the past. You'd be able to measure how much growth you have in an orchard from year to year.
Nichols says the computer software brings all the images together, creating a 3D map with all sorts of layers. For instance, with a click, the trees can be removed and just their shadows are left. The more light shining through the canopy, the more water the orchard needs.
We don't know how much water younger trees use. And from that, we'd be able to better dial in how much water we need to give to our pistachio and almond trees.
A 160-acre field can take just under 2 hours to map. Dr. Yangquan Chen runs the drone lab at UC Merced. He says this technology, once fully fleshed out, may greatly affect how farmers manage their crops.
I think he's one of the earliest proponents for this technique. It's a very early stage, and I believe it is quite pioneering for the precision agriculture.
But at the same time, Chen says the virtual mapping technology needs a lot of testing before farmers are going to trust the data it computes.
More research is needed to make sense of the sensor data. The question probably is the cost, and are we getting less and pay more, or pay less and get more? That's not very clear.
Back in Parlier, the drone is about finished collecting data. Ali Porezo will take the thousands of images back to his lab, where they'll be stitched together into a 3D model. In his office, he's showing me an animation of an orchard.
So you now can see that we have the information from all sides of the tree. As you move your position, which is the camera position, you can see how the tree looks like, how tall is it, how wide is it.
Porezza says this is just the beginning of using virtual orchards to help farmers make clearer decisions about their crops. He says he's willing to work with all sorts of researchers to see how the data he collects can help not just farmers, but irrigation specialists and soil scientists. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Thirty years ago, a bird native to California was on the brink of extinction. Known for its impressive size, the California condor has been the target of recovery efforts ever since. FM 89's Laura Tsutsui recently visited a release site in Kern County to see the birds and learn how recovery efforts have hit a new milestone.
At the Bitter Creek National Wildlife Refuge, two adult California condors are perching on what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service call a flight pen. We're standing on a hill within a fenced enclosure, and in the center is a huge cage with nine condors inside. All but one of these vulture-like birds are juveniles. Their bald heads are black, not yet the reddish pink that the adult condors sitting outside the pen have. Steve Kirkland is the field coordinator for the service's condor recovery program.
The wingspan is 9.5 feet, which is probably almost as wide as like a Volkswagen Bug. When they soar closely over your head, you can hear wind moving through their feathers.
You never start at the beak end. You always move your hand away from the beak.
Joseph Brandt is the supervisory wildlife biologist with the program. He's teaching an intern how to hold a condor so he can attach ID tags and GPS units to the birds.
They don't have vocal cords, so they don't have a call, but they do make sort of guttural, you know, they can move air and they can sort of hiss and grunt.
That's Josh Felch, a biologist with the program, demonstrating the condor noises. Members from the Condor Recovery Program are at Bitter Creek to visit new condors that just arrived at the refuge from a hatchery in Idaho. In a few weeks, six of the birds at Bitter Creek will be released into the wild.
So at one time, condors were, you know, at very, very low numbers in the early 1980s. In fact, their wild population was only about 22 birds in the wild and only one in captivity.
When the Condor Recovery Program began, all condors were brought into captive breeding programs. And now, decades later, biologists are defining the final stages of recovery. Wild condor populations are growing, and they're flying and nesting in areas they haven't used in decades. Historic nesting areas of California condors include the foothills and mountains in what are now Fresno and Tulare counties. The birds would fly south into Kern and Ventura counties and up the coast of California, creating a U-shaped range. Condors have been introduced to the wild from Bitter Creek Refuge and the Big Sur area, returning them directly to their coastal and southern historic nesting areas. Recently, biologists have noticed that condors are repopulating more areas in Central California. 20 years ago, this would not have been possible. Today, the state hosts a population of 160 condors. Together with wild birds in Arizona and Mexico, the total population of California condors is around 440 birds. Brandt says they don't know what a healthy number of condors in the wild is because condor populations have declined since humans settled in California. Historic records show that California condors used to live throughout the state and Northwest. Even Lewis and Clark recorded seeing them during their expeditions.
When Europeans came to the West, they really had an impact on ecosystems, and one of those impacts affected the food sources of condors.
Condors are scavengers that eat carrion. They'll eat meat that died from natural causes or was killed. They don't hunt like other carnivores. Brandt calls them nature's cleanup crew. Because of their diet, activities like hunting and ranching are helpful for the birds. That can mean their dinner. But lead poisoning from consuming lead ammunition has been a prevalent cause of death for condors.
The population modeling that we've done, lead is really the thing holding condors back from becoming self-sustaining.
Brandt says that their work includes educating and reaching out to hunters and ranchers to make areas safer for condors to repopulate. Jennifer Wesson with the Fresno Chaffee Zoo says that the condor recovery program demonstrates the success of collaborating with these local players.
Sometimes it's an outreach that will save an animal, such as when the pesticides were thinning eggshells for birds. We had problems with that. Lead poisoning is another issue. That was an example of just getting out some education, getting out the outreach, getting people to change their habits.
At Bitter Creek, a condor sitting on the flight pen spreads its wings and takes off. In a few weeks, the newly GPS-tagged birds in the flight pen will join the wild population, and Brandt hopes for a successful transition.
This is the recovery program, so our goal is to recover the species such that we no longer need to manage them as intensively.
The largest flying bird in North America might someday sustain itself without humans, but it could be some time until then.
I think we're kind of at a point where we're going to start defining what recovery, what actual, no longer threatened, but what actually recovery would be for the condor. I don't think that, you know, this is going to happen in a year or two, but I think 10 years from now we'll probably be a long way down that road in kind of understanding what the numbers and what recovery would look like, and also achieving recovery.
So maybe you shouldn't be surprised if you see a black bird with a 9-foot wingspan on your way into the mountains. And as recovery continues, maybe someday you can expect it. Reporting from Maricopa, I'm Laura Satsui.
This is Valley Edition. Last week was a bad one for one of California Governor Jerry Brown's biggest priorities, the project known as California Water Fix, the $16 billion plan to build two tunnels under the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta aims to improve the reliability of water deliveries to farms and cities. Instead of pumping water out of the Delta to send south, the tunnels would take water from the north under the environmentally sensitive estuary and send it to the San Joaquin Valley, where farmers use it, as well as cities in Southern California. But last week, the state's largest irrigation district, Fresno-based Westlands, voted not to participate in the project. Here to tell us more is FM89's ag reporter, Ezra David Romero. Ezra, welcome.
Hey, Joe.
So farmers have been talking about the need for improved reliability of water deliveries for years. The tunnels were sold or are being sold by the governor as a good thing for farmers who haven't been getting the water they're under contract for a long time due to the environmental concerns in the Delta. Why did Westlands vote no?
Well, the vote came as sort of a surprise. They were going to just talk about it on Tuesday, and they ended up voting no on it. And it comes down to funding, a huge portion of it. There's about 600 families that are part of the Westlands Water District, and those 600 families were going to have to make up $3 billion, right? And Westlands felt like it wasn't enough equity in that for them to go to contribute that $3 billion. It wasn't spread that out, and it wasn't going to make sense because they weren't going to get enough water in return.
So essentially it's a dollars and cents thing right now, according to Westlands. Now, this is a significant thing because, as I understand it, the project essentially would be paid for through the people who use it, both farmers and cities, whether
exactly.
In Southern California or Silicon Valley. Right now, this is, as I understand, the first vote that has taken place so far, but there were others that shortly followed.
Yeah, it was the first vote. They voted 7-1 to not support the project. The board of Zone 7 Water Agency, they serve Alameda County. That's about 220,000 customers, and they voted 5-2 to support the project. But they're a very small portion. It's 1% of the funding for the project, $250,000, and they rely on 80% of their water from the Delta. And then there's some others that are going to be coming up soon. The Metropolitan Water District in Los Angeles, that they'll contribute $4 billion to the project, serving 19 million Southern Californians. They're going to vote October 10th. The Kern County Water Agency is polling 13 of its agencies, and they're going to decide by October 12th. And then Santa Clara Valley Water District on October 17th.
So a big turning point right now for this project, whether it goes forward or changes, there's been some talk of maybe scaling it back, maybe building one tunnel only. What are people saying about that? Is that now a possibility?
It is a possibility. There are a couple possibilities. One, that taxpayers could pay for this, but that's not getting traction anywhere from congressmen to water districts. And the other thought is to have one smaller tunnel, and that is possible. Metropolitan is kind of pushing for that, and so are some agencies in Kern County. But there's some problems with that, because this whole thing is based off of these two pumps in the Delta, right? When they're operating, it reverses the flow of the water in the Delta, and that sucks up fish. And, you know, the Delta's environmentally fragile. And so they say if there's one of these pumps still in action and one tunnel, it could still have that same impact. Jay Lunn with the UC Davis's Watershed Sciences, he says just that.
So what is Westlands going to do now at this point? I know there was a report yesterday from a bond rating agency, Fitch, that came out and said they think that the deal might not be completely dead, that there might be some negotiation. Is that still a possibility that this could be reopened at some point with Westlands?
If you think about our last 5 years of life here in the Central Valley, we were in this time of drought, right, where thousands of acres were fallowed and things like that. And so if Westlands doesn't receive water, they're going to have to fallow land and things like that. So there could be some tension in the future there that could force them to renegotiate.
Now, this was also interesting because I think maybe for the first time ever, you had some of Westland's fiercest opponents, the Restore the Delta group out of the Delta area, out of Stockton, actually applauding a move by the water district. They don't like each other very much. What are environmental groups saying about this?
You know, some environmental groups, it's sort of this like quasi thing where some environmental groups hate it still and some love it. And one group I spoke with last week loved the idea that it's not going to pass. They would rather have some other project go into effect.
So what's the next step here? You say that there's some big votes here. Where does this go from here?
You know, the state says they're still going to move forward with this, that they're not letting go of it, right? They've spent 10, 15 years on it, right, in the second iteration of the Delta Tunnel plan, the second time Governor Brown has done it. So they're still moving forward, but if some of these other larger districts vote against it, who knows how it's going to be funded, and maybe it will die. But at this point, it's not dying.
Well, it's very interesting. We will continue to follow that story here on Valley Public Radio. Again, the news last week that the board of the Westlands Water District in Fresno voted 7-1 to not move forward with a plan to help pay for the $16 billion California water fix to build two tunnels under the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Westlands would have paid for about $3 billion of that under the plan that was voted on last week. We'll see if that changes or if it comes back, and you'll hear it here on Valley Public Radio. Ezra, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
And stay with us on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back in just a bit. In the next half of our show, we'll talk with comedian Paula Poundstone about her upcoming trip to Fresno later this week, and also about her new podcast with NPR and her new book. Plus, Stylian Kirov, the conductor of the Bakersfield Symphony, joins us to talk about that orchestra's new season. It's all coming up on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's fall, and that means it's time for a new season of concerts from the Bakersfield Symphony Orchestra. And here joining us now to tell us more, we have on the phone with us Stylian Kirov. He is the conductor and music director of the symphony. Stylian, welcome.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Stylian, I want to talk about the various concerts you have coming up, including this one on September 29th. a very interesting way to start your season with Every Good Boy Deserves Favor. And it comes from the composer and conductor Andre Previn. Tell us about this work.
Sure. Yes, it's a very, very exciting work. And actually, we're doing something a little bit outside of the box. It's actually a work that it's a play by Tom Stoppard, and the music was written by Andre Previn. And it's actually a play for actors and orchestra. It's a very, very interesting piece of work, and it's really very unique because, to be quite honest, I cannot really think of another work that unifies both worlds of theater and music as well. Well, obviously, you know, we have Igor Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale as well, but it involves only one to three actors, and it has some dance. But in this case, Every Good Boy Deserves Favors, it's very unique. It's a full stage play, and the orchestra is one of the images, one of the characters of the play.
So tell us a little more about what it's about.
Well, it's the story is very interesting. It's a story that happens basically in a mental asylum in Russia. So there is a lot of truth to the story, and there is also, but there is also a lot of humor to it as well. So it's a nice mixture between these both two aspects. So the story is about two patients in the mental hospital. One is named Alexander Ivanov, and the other is also named Alexander Ivanov. So one believes that he has an orchestra in his mind, and he talks about the different instruments. There are a lot of different jokes about the orchestra itself. And the other believes that actually sane people who are, let's say, inconvenient for the government are put in mental institutions. And so there are many, many different aspects of the play. Obviously, one of the Ivanovs, who is kind of leading the revolution, basically, has a son as well. And it's a very complex, very full concept. But I'm not sure if I should actually say how the play ends.
Yeah, we don't want to give that away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's I feel it's a brilliant, brilliant piece of theater, and of course the music and the orchestra within the frame of theater, I think it's absolutely genius.
Is this something that's difficult by the sheer fact of how unusual this work is? Is it difficult to rehearse and put together with the orchestra?
Sure. Well, it's very different to begin with from everything I have done in the past, and it's a piece where obviously you have to worry about the music. There are technical musical challenges, but it's also synchronizing the play and the music and actually merging both universes. I think that's the challenging aspect, but it's also very, very exciting aspect as well. So as a conductor, you really need to know not only the music, but you also need to know very well the script.
We're talking with Stylian Kirov, the conductor and music director of the Bakersfield Symphony Orchestra, beginning its new season September 29th at the Rabobank Theater in downtown Bakersfield. The orchestra is back just a little over a week later with another concert, the 100 Years of Leonard Bernstein, celebrating his centennial. You have a program that's primarily Bernstein, but you also have the Ravel Piano Concerto. How do those two things relate? How does the Bernstein program relate to Ravel?
Well, it's a very interesting question, actually. And I have to say, Bernstein was very well known. He was not only a great conductor. He was a great pianist. He was a great educator. He was also a wonderful composer as well. So when we were looking at different programs, we came up with a program only of Bernstein's pieces. Bernstein was very, very inspired by Ravel's music as well. And so what we decided to do is actually include one of the pieces that he played and conducted from the piano as well. So there is a famous video recording of him playing the Ravel piano concerto and conducting it in the same time. So we thought, you know, this was really a piece that he was very close to, and we wanted to create some diversity within the program. So we decided to include this piece as well.
So you have in that concert the famous Candide Overture, also his first symphony, right, and the symphonic dances. With the Ravel piece, you have a piano soloist who was the silver medalist at one of the recent Van Cliburn piano competitions, Kenneth Broberg. Tell me about him. Have you worked with him before? What are you looking forward to there?
Yeah, I have never worked with him before. I just heard the wonderful compliments he received in the competition, and I watched some of his performances during the competition. But he's really a rising star right now, so he's I'm sure his career will flourish as he gets more opportunities. In my experience, everybody who is a prize winner at the Cliburn competition is, first of all, a wonderful human being, and second of all, a wonderful, extraordinary musician.
There's another concert coming up this fall, November 4th. You call it Romantic Landscapes, and some true masterworks from the Romantic era here. We have Brahms Symphony No. 4, Antonin Dvorak's Concerto for Cello, Strauss's Die Fledermaus Overture. Tell me about this concert, some true highlights here from the Romantic era and lovers of that style.
Yes, absolutely, and that was really the goal of the concert, is to highlight the romantic some romantic masterpieces, and yet still have diversity within the program, although some very strong connection between the pieces as well. The obvious connection between Dvorak and Brahms is the fact that they actually knew each other. And Dvorak had very big support from Brahms. He was, in a way, his protege. The Fourth Symphony, I feel it really stands on the golden pages of the symphonic literature. It's a true masterpiece and a really precious gem. The Dvorak Cello Concerto, it's another masterpiece from the cello solo literature. And I'm very excited to be working with Maya Bogdanovic, who is our soloist for this program. I haven't had the chance to work with her before, but she's somebody who is also really up and coming, wonderful career, flourishing in Europe and now hopefully in the United States. So we are very, very lucky to have her for this concert. And of course, finishing the concert with Strauss's Fledermaus Overture, I think it's a wonderful finale and a great way to celebrate this era in a way, this romantic era. So if you look at this program, it's a little bit of an upside-down concert, because we start with the symphony, then we'll have an intermission, then we will have the concerto, and then we finish with the Fledermaus Overture. It's not uncommon. This has been, but it's historically correct. I can say things have been done like this in the past. Many programs have been programmed like this in the past. So we just decided to present this concert this way, and I think this is also another concert to really look forward to.
Well, and certainly will leave audiences with all those great melodies in their heads as they leave the Rabobank Theater November 4th. You were talking about careers that are rising stars. You have some news in your career front. Recently, you won the first prize at the Berlin competition in the conducting category, Debut Berlin. Tell me about that. What was it like taking the stage of Berlin Philharmonic Hall? And this is where Karajan and so many great conductors were.
Right. Well, this was, of course, very, very exciting, and I was very privileged to be there. It was a wonderful experience to make music in this beautiful venue. And, you feel that the ghosts of the great conductors are still there. You know, you see all these pictures, you see all this history, and it's a phenomenal experience for every musician, I think. And I'm very hopeful to return there one day. The concert was very exciting. I thought it went very well. Really beautiful music making and great orchestra as well. So it was all very inspiring, very positive experience.
Well, and I think the audience will be equally inspired as well. Coming up again, the Bakersfield Symphony Orchestra takes to the Rabobank Theater stage to open its new season September 29th with Every Good Boy Deserves Favor. It's a stage play by Tom Stoppard with music by Andre Previn, featuring the orchestra as an essential character in that play. Very unique piece taking place September 29th and then back on October 7th with 100 Years of Leonard Bernstein, featuring the Ravel Piano Concerto and an otherwise all Bernstein concert program. And then November 4th, Romantic Landscapes, featuring Brahms, Dvorak, and Strauss. That's all coming up. Stillian, we really are so excited to have you back in our community for another season and look forward to all that 2017 and 18 will bring.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's a real pleasure, and I'm very, very much looking forward to this exciting next season.
Tickets are now available for Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Hi, I'm Keisha Rajani with California Health Sciences University. We're excited to help sponsor your chance to win $10,000. Tickets are $75 and only 800 will be sold. Second prize is a cool getaway to Big Sur. Third place is a $500 Amazon gift card.
The final days are here. Thursday, September 28th is your last chance to order tickets.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. NPR listeners know Paula Poundstone for her humor on the program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's bringing that unique style of funny making to the Tower Theater in Fresno for a performance September 28th. And Paula Poundstone joins us now on FM 89. Paula, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Paula is very busy. She's not only appearing on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and doing tours like this, but she also has a new book out, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Also, a new podcast from NPR live from the Poundstone Institute. Paula, how do you find time to do all this stuff? This seems like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, but you know what? It's work that sort of refuels itself. It's fun work. I'm the luckiest performer in the entire world. I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry, it's good for the audience to come out and laugh for the night, and it's good for me too. It goes a long way towards healing the staggering depression that the last year has caused in all of the world. So it makes for a fun night.
Is it difficult for you, given the times that we're in right now, to stay funny? When we heard the president recently at the United Nations promising the total destruction of North Korea. These are very serious times. How does comedy fit in your view?
Oh, I think it's really important. I think it's a coping mechanism that nature has given us for just this moment, actually. It's really weird hearing that you're, headed towards nuclear war. But on the bright side, I like to tell myself, I do think it's going to bring back folk music. And I love folk music. So, so there is that. A night of telling my little jokes in front of an audience, it sort of feels like we're watching it from a distance more somehow for that particular stretch of time anyways, it's like we're all huddled together making jokes and then we have to go back out into the world. But the period of time where we're huddled together making jokes is really, really fun.
How does this podcast differ from what the other things that
you know
do?
What? I hate to say this, but can you hold on just a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Something got stuck.
So with that, Paula, I have to follow up with a different question. 14 cats, is that at last count, or maybe has it changed since the...
I do have 14 cats, yeah. Yeah, actually,
How does one get 14 cats?
I had 16 and two died. That's how I did it.
Oh.
People say to me all the time, they'll go, oh, do they find you? No, they don't find me. I've gone to the shelter and gotten cats 14 times. In fact, far more than that, because I've had many more in my lifetime. But I also have two German Shepherd mixed dogs who are on the verge of driving me crazy right now in my room. I have a housekeeper. We have so much fur between the cats and the dogs that you really have to vacuum. Certainly every other day, maybe every day. And so I have someone come in like a couple mornings a week, mostly just to vacuum. And she just came to my bedroom door, and she doesn't speak English very well, and I speak very little Spanish, and so we don't do that good together communication-wise. But from what I could make out, there was a toy mouse stuck in the vacuum cleaner hose. And when she went to get the toy mouse out, she used, I think she used like a wooden dowel of some for, and it's now the dowel is stuck in the vacuum cleaner, and that's what she came to tell me.
Oh, no.
I said, just don't worry about it. I'll take care of it later.
So were the German Shepherds first, or are these cats, and how did they?
No, I've had the cats for longer than I've had the dogs, and the cats pretty much school the dogs. You know, every now and then they like to run through the mass of cats and make them scatter everywhere. But for the most part, it's the other way around. For the most part, the cats dominate the dogs.
Did they have any idea what they were getting themselves into? Wait, there's 14 cats in this house?
Yeah. I think they were all excited when I first brought them home from the shelter. And then they're like, wait, not so much. No, they get along, actually. They do get along. And they were, and you know, we've had this heat wave. It's hard to complain about weather because of all the horrible natural disasters around the world right now. So while poor Florida and Texas and the areas were suffering so horribly badly, we were having a heat wave here in Southern California. No one hardly mentioned it because it seemed rude under the circumstances, but it was the hottest temperatures I've ever experienced in Southern California, and my cats were just draped everywhere. Sometimes I feel guilty that I don't pet them enough, but I had a break from that guilt during the heat wave because they didn't even want pet. They were just like, "Don't touch me, it's hot." It was, yeah. Anyways, the good thing about having 14 cats, and there's very little good about it, but the good thing about 14 cats is that I never have to watch a YouTube cat video because there's one in front of me 24 hours a day.
So you have this new podcast out, and this is a little different than some of the things you do, but it's also in front of a live audience. Why is that, and how is the podcast working out?
It's been fun. It's called Live from the Poundstone Institute. It's a comedy podcast made by NPR. Each episode is a quest to find all the world's knowledge and mock it relentlessly. We do it in front of a small, live and lively audience. Right now, we're taping it in a performance space in the back of a comic book store in Hollywood, and there's a dungeon-esque quality about it, but it's, as it was described to me, a low-ceilinged, high-energy room. It's been fun. You know, the backbone of the show is talking to the scientists who do the unlikely studies that are often, became sort of a staple of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And Doug Berman, who makes Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Car Talk, had the idea that what if I had the chance to talk to those scientists? And so it's not the whole show, but it's the backbone of the show. And we've also had some of the funniest people alive come on to take the Poundstone personality survey. We've had Dana Carvey, Larry Wilmore, Jay Leno, Dick Cavett, Tig Notaro, Kevin Nealon, Tiffany Haddish, and we just had John Waters and Ed Begley Jr. So it's been a hoot. It's been fun. And I don't know, it's a podcast. One of the few things that we have in common as human beings at this point in our lives is that, we don't eat our young and we have a podcast. everyone has a podcast. And you can find it, by the way, through the NPR website or through my website or through iTunes or what do they always say in advertising, wherever fine podcasts are available.
Now, you also have the new book. I understand this is This is a memoir in some sense, not it's just a comedy work.
Yes, definitely. It's a funny book. That's its number one job. It's about my life raising a house full of kids and animals. But I tell the story of that through the course of conducting experiments, doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. Each chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. And it took place over the course of 7 years. So it tells the story of my kids growing up and my challenge to, figure out parenting to the best of my ability. And the experiments were largely, simple experiments. They ranged. One, for example, was I went backpacking with my oldest daughter, who, by the way, has cerebral palsy and I have a bad back. So we were quite a pair to draw to. In one of the experiments is I hug everyone I meet. One of the experiments is called the Get Wired experiment, where I learned to use a computer. That chapter probably took place several years ago, but even so, I came to computers later than many people did. And what's really interesting about that chapter, I mean, mostly its job is to be funny, but it's also real. I mean, I was quite sincere in my effort, and I did keep careful field notes. One of the fascinating things about the Get Wired experiment is by the time I came to computers, a lot of people were already doing that stuff and already weren't recognizing how it was affecting their lives. And it was a byproduct. I didn't do this intentionally. The experiments were sincere, and therefore I actually didn't know where they would take me. But it was interesting after the fact to realize that, I was an uncompromised brain before I began that experiment. And I was most people don't recognize. Most people are sort of a frog in a pot over what's happened to them with these silly, stupid, horrible, awful machines. And, as I looked back on my notes, on my field notes from this period where I was learning to use a computer, the word lonely, the word exhausted came up a lot. Frustrated. There is no frustration like computer frustration, except for maybe dealing with like the healthcare system. But it was interesting. I mean, I didn't write it to prove that that computers are awful. But I got to say, as you read that chapter, you go like, oh wow, yeah, they are kind of awful. Whereas, had I not kept notes before, I'm not sure I would have remembered by now that they are. Oh, anyways, one of the chapters is I take up swing dancing, which I absolutely suck at, but I love. I started out, because my idea was it was upbeat music and it was, a group experience. And so it would be good, socially, it would be fun. And, I was so bad that I really had to, I was holding the group back. So I started taking privately, which, of course, did away with the social aspect of it. And then my teacher couldn't even use the upbeat music because I was just so bad. I mostly swing dance to the blues. I do the Charleston to Fire and Rain. It looks like Tai Chi when I do it.
Paula Poundstone with us today on Valley Public Radio. She's going to be in Fresno at the Tower Theater, September 28th. Before we go, Paula, you've been on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for how many years now?
I'm not sure. I think 15 or 16.
How has that evolved, this being in the same room on the same stage with Peter and the other regular guests that are on there? Is there a familiarity that allows you two to feed off of each other, or is it sometimes more beneficial from a comedy standpoint to have those fresh interactions? What's that like, getting to know Peter and working together for so long on that?
One of the joys of my life is trying to knock Peter off his horse. Oh, wait, don't tell me. The truth is, people come up to me all the time. They go, oh, I listen to you every week on Wait, Don't Tell Me. And although I never say this in front of them, the truth is, I'm not on every week. Because we have for those who don't know, it's a weekly news quiz show And we have a panel of three each week who compete, I don't know, for the mantle of most informed, I guess. But it's a comedy show. Our first job is to be funny. They must have about maybe 15 panelists that we rotate in no particular order that I know of. But I end up being on, well, I'm on probably once a month, but then when they take a vacation and they do like a, you know, a clip show or something, I tend to be on the clip shows and the vacation shows. So I guess it gives the illusion that I'm there a couple of times a month. But so I don't know, because I'm not there, and it's only a weekly show, so it's already not as frequent as one might think. And then, of course, it's like last week I was on with Amy Dickinson, who I love, and I don't know, somebody was asking me like how many times I've been on with Amy Dickinson, and the truth is, you know, go back over 16 years and then you go, well, I'm only on once a month, and you go, you know, a handful of times. So there's a, you know, there's still a fresh quality about being on with each of these guys. And the show is based on the week's news, and therefore, and the comics, well, not the comics, the panelists have no script. We know that the questions are going to be about the week's news, but we don't, I mean, as far as I know, none of us like write jokes ahead of time for it or anything like that. It really is very spontaneous for the panel anyways. And so there's generally speaking a very fresh feeling about each show. And it's really fun to do. I mean, I have made a career for 30 something years working alone. So it's fun to be with other people on stage.
And you can see that solo show with Paula Poundstone headlining at the Tower Theater September 28th in Fresno. Again, tickets are available there, and Paula joins us now. You can hear her on the new Poundstone podcast, live from the Poundstone Institute. It's available on the NPR app, and her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. It came out earlier this year. Paula Poundstone, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. It was fun talking with you.
And again, that show coming up Thursday, September 28th, Paula Poundstone in Fresno. Again, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to encourage you to check out our website at kvpr.org. You can find our audio archives and podcasts there as well. Subscribe to our Outdoorsy podcast, Valley Edition, and all of our local news archives there on the website. And while you're there, send us an email. We're talk@kvpr.org. And also on Twitter, @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, and our newest addition to the FM 89 news team, Laura Tsutsui, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.